Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
Now it is time. We started.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Humans face death and dream of their legacy. Might it be different one day? Our minds, uploaded, immortal. Our legacy, alive in computer systems, the realm of robots. And then, flesh and blood left behind in a bygone organic age. It's the premise of a new opera, a robot's opera. This hour on Point, Todd Machover's new opera, Death and the Powers. You can join the conversation. Is this the oldest dream, the immortal spirit, the living legacy, or something new? Would you upload forever? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Death and the Powers, the Robots Opera, premiered last fall in Monaco. It opens in North America on March 18th in Boston, on April 2nd in Chicago. Joining me now in our studio are two of the big names behind the opera. Todd Machover is the composer of Death and the Powers. He's been called America's most wired composer by the Los Angeles Times. He's professor of music and media and director of the Opera of the Future group at the MIT Media Lab. Todd Machover, welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be here, Tom.
And with us is Diane Paulus, director of the opera's North American premiere this month in Boston, Cambridge. She's artistic director of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, also director of the Donkey Show, celebrated disco interpretation of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and the Tony Award-winning revival of Hair. Now on tour, Diane Paulus, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Todd Machover, tell us the story. Here's Simon Powers, your eccentric billionaire, and what does he do?
So he's a rich, successful, powerful guy in his late 60s. We kind of think of him as a combination of Howard Hughes and Walt Disney and Bill Gates, somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he partly wants to live forever, even more than that. He wants to leave the world but leave everything about himself here. So he uses all of his power and his success to invent something he calls the system, which allows him to download himself into his environment. And the opera opens, when you see the characters, it opens with him just about to turn on this system, just about to leave everything about himself, his memories, his ability to still be in touch with the people he loves, maybe to still manipulate his businesses. He's about to leave all of that in the environment and to go himself. He turns it on, says, see you later, and then the opera really starts.
And of course, the twist on all this is that the opera itself is being told somewhere in the distant future by robots who have been following instructions from the humans now gone, the flesh and blood humans now gone, that this is something that they must do, a ritual that they must carry out. Here's a little bit of the robots themselves talking to one another early on in the show. They are immortal. Death itself, the idea of flesh and blood and death, doesn't really make sense to them. They're talking about this ritual as they prepare to enact it.
Death, death, death. Exit a cost. Death, a form of entropy. Your data rearranged. Why did the human creators plan a performance? All a theme impossible to comprehend. What is suffering? How can I perceive what I cannot feel?
All we can understand.
The robot chorus there in Death and the Powers, about to enact a ritual recreation of the moment when, as presented, I guess, the first human sort of uploads and steps into that digital realm. Alex McDowell, who did a lot of the artistic direction for Minority Report, very much involved in the visual presentation of this on stage. Diane Paulus, give us a kind of a visual description of what we see here. I mean, there are literally robots, but not only that. What's the representation of humans who do eventually emerge here as reenacted by robots, but anyway, in human form? What's the visual representation of this merger?
I think it's important to note that while the opera starts with a chorus of nine robots, we do have live human beings, yes, in this opera. And as Todd mentioned, when the robots enact the ritual, that's when the live opera singers take over, mm-hmm, as if the robots have transformed themselves exactly, mm-hmm, into human form. Then the challenge here was really to create a production design that had the character of the title of Simon, the title character Simon. So how do you make your set design have idiosyncratic personality traits? How can you think about production design in a different way?
And we should say he is, as Todd said, he's merged with his environment. It's essentially his home. It's as if it's the very walls and artifacts of the home are infused with digital everything.
Indeed.
And he's in there.
Indeed. So we have these giant wall systems which have all kinds of VersaTube light effects in them that Todd can explain how Simon Powers' voice triggers displays. And this is all done live. So it's not a sort of pre-programmed technological push-go. It's actually reacting live to the performance of Jim Magdalena, who plays the title role. We also have a giant chandelier, which comes to life, and Simon Powers...
Doesn't every opera have a giant chandelier?
Yeah, I know. Don't I want one in my living room? Yes.
We don't make love with all of them, sort of.
I know. This one you can, indeed. Mm. That was a fun thing when we said his third wife, Evie, has an intimate encounter with the chandelier. I remember when we put that in the libretto, we thought, okay, how are we going to do that one? And... also, you know, the robots continue to be part of the enactment, and they take on different forms and structures and help express the life of Simon once he has, quote unquote, disappeared.
You know, Todd, it's funny that it's coming out now in the States. Of course, it was Monaco last fall. We'll talk about that. But it comes out as, I mean, the cover of Time magazine, for heaven's sakes, is talking about exactly or some version of the merger that your lead character, Simon Powers, is undergoing here, this notion of the singularity. 2045, Time magazine's article says.
It should have said 2011, right?
Say 2011 in Death and the Powers. But the moment when... what computers reach a scale, such a scale of capacity that they can sort of absorb the human mind, and maybe minds live on without the flesh and blood. When you started working on this, did you anticipate that we were headed toward people talking about this not just as a fictional notion, as a sort of mythological high tech playing out, but as a real option within the lifetimes of perhaps people in your audiences?
Yeah, so there are two sides of that. You know, I work at MIT at the Media Lab, so I'm definitely surrounded by many people who think about these issues all the time and who work on questions of extending human capabilities, both mental capabilities or physical capabilities. So this discussion is something very real. In many ways, I think Diane and I both, our fundamental interest in this story from the very beginning was kind of the opposite,
mm-hmm,
because what this story really is about is the desire to leave our legacy and perpetuate all of our lives forever, and maybe the reality of doing that, but also the question of what that means to everybody else, what it means to the people who are left. So if somebody we love really does live forever and can tell their stories forever, is that necessarily...
If mom or dad, who's kind of dead but not really, is still in the walls and speaking with you, as we
well,
see,
well, it's good and it's bad points. But I think what the opera is really about is thinking about this question of perpetuating a life, thinking about the question of sharing a legacy, and thinking about what the limits of that are today and maybe forever.
Here's a moment in the opera, Death and the Powers, where Simon Powers begins to make that transition. He says, "It's not the material that matters."
"And you see, it's true.
It isn't the blood, it isn't the bone. It's never the matter that matters. Particles, molecules, cells, fingers, eyes, nerves are only places for the system of meaningful vibration. It's all in the meaning, the movement. It's all in the meaning, the movement. It's all in the meaning, the idea. That's the idea.
It isn't the blood, it isn't the bone. Diane Paulus, there's a very ancient impulse here to leave a legacy, and yet the technology this time makes it not present in some sweet by-and-by or in a reenacted rituals, but actually there in the walls of this home with the loves and the children left behind interacting with that. Something very old and something very new here.
I think the key is this idea of the people that are left behind who have to contend with who is my father if he's not a real person in flesh and blood. So you're talking about his beloved daughter, Miranda, who's really a central character in the opera. Evie, his third wife, devoted wife to Simon. How does she continue to feel like she has a husband? How can she stay intimate with him if he's no longer flesh and blood? And then, of course, the last major character is his adopted son, who's kind of his science protege, himself half-system, someone who Simon Powers rescued as a child and enabled him. He's part robotic himself, so enabled him to survive. So it was very important that these human relationships be central to the drama and not just, you know, a meditation on technology, but really about love and what it means to be in relationship to one another.
Absolutely. Ancient there and yet new at the same time as we look at as a technological frontier that may put a fresh twist on these very, very old issues. Todd Machover and Diane Paulus, please stand by. We're talking about death and the powers, the robots opera, and an imagined time when flesh and blood are history. We'll go out of this segment with Simon disappearing into the system. He asserts over and over here, again, I am the same. Listeners, can you picture it? Well, this, could this be your legacy? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I did that, and I am the same. I am the same.
One arm of magnesium and nickel, graphite, silicon, and cable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Death and the Powers, the Robots opera, and an imagined time when flesh and blood are history. Todd Machover joins us, composer and inventor. He's been called America's most wired composer. He's composer of Death and the Powers, the Robots opera. Opens in Boston on March 18th and Chicago on April 2nd. You can find out about tickets and video and pictures, all that at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also read the entire draft of the libretto by poet laureate Robert Pinsky. Really, really interesting thing both to read and to see. And right here, you can hear. 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you know the urge of Simon Powers not to die, not to fully die, to have your mind live on? Is this the human future, the human destiny? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And let's get our listeners right in here. Jason in Newton, Massachusetts is on the line. Hi, Jason. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, this is a really interesting topic, and I've been thinking of this stuff since Mona Lisa Overdrive by William Gibson, when the protagonist from the Sproul trilogy, Count Zero, or Bobby Newmark, is hooked up to this machine, and his body's failing, and there's IV bags everywhere, and you don't really know what's going on right away. This guy's basically just been paid to keep this guy alive and keep him hooked up to this machine. But then you find out, you know, as you read the book and finish the trilogy, that it's Bobby Newmark, and he's in this machine called an Aelith, which is like a copy of reality. So it's all about like sort of transcending and transferring your sentience. And I just think that it's it's the type of thing where if science and sort of our art and our reading of this ever converges, it's, you know, really going to change the way, you know, humanity and sentience is considered. I mean, the idea of falling in love with an artificial intelligence or, you know, just transhumanism in general is just a really interesting thought. The idea of like a Hamlet moment where a robot is sitting there holding the skull from its former body, you know, thinking about its life when it was a carbon-based organism. I just think it's, you know, a really great thing. I haven't seen the opera yet, but I can't wait.
You might have that moment.
you may indeed.
Yeah, that's a good image.
Yeah,
it's
very good.
It is.
Diane, we still have time to add that.
Get out the skull. Jason, I'm so glad you called. I mean, it's interesting, Todd. This is so much in the culture right now. This doesn't sound like murky science fiction. The idea of, you know, transferring sentience, it's not only in high-tech laboratories now. This is, and it's been around, since Frankenstein, I guess, in a way, Mary Shelley. But it's very much in the air right now, this idea that we may be on this cusp. How did you think about it at the beginning of your visualization, your conceptualization of this show? What issues? You may have started with legacy. You fused them with technology. What issues emerge from that contemplation?
Well, I think there were two parallel ideas that I was very concerned with when I started thinking about the show before we had a story, before I contacted Robert Pinsky, who was the first collaborator on the piece. One was not only the question of legacy, but the question of how difficult it is to capture everything that's essential about a human being and to transfer that it's interesting to try.
Now and in history, once you're gone, it just goes with you.
Well, it's even more than that. I'm reading right now the Mark Twain autobiography, and that's so interesting because here's this guy who, an unbelievable writer who struggled very, very deeply to express anything about his life. So the autobiography are a bunch of patchworks, and in there is a statement where he says that the more he writes his autobiography, the more he realizes that the texture of a life is not your actions and it's not your words. It's all of the internal thought and internal talking to yourself and all the things that he himself can't figure out how to put down in his autobiography. It's a very rich texture that's very, very difficult to convey to anybody.
But this has been central to the human experience, that rich, rich texture is typically lost when someone dies, and we have to recreate in every generation. We try and hang on. We have texts and scripture and all of our efforts. But now there's this possibility of more than that you're pointing to in
Death
I think, and the Powers.
I think that the interesting, you know, I've worked for a long time now with technology to use it to expand human potential, and also I'm very aware of what its limits are. And I think the interesting thing is that technology forces this issue, as you say. It gives us a possibility of capturing many things that weren't possible before, certainly of prolonging things. But it also, since when something is transmitted into technological form, it's also the best way to analyze what you have and what you don't have. It's like when you write a piece of computer software to compose a piece of music, and you give it all the rules of how music works, and then it writes this piece of music, and you listen to it, and you go, yeah, that's like 95% of a really good piece of music, but there's something missing. Well, what is missing? We don't know that yet, and we may never know that. And I think the interesting question is, what's this last 5% of being a human being that we haven't been able to define and capture yet?
Diane Paulus, is it liberating to see human character, human nature on the stage in the opera put up against that technological frontier, or is it diminishing somehow? I mean, after all, you start the play with flesh and blood humans as gone as dinosaurs.
I think what interests me so much about this opera is that the story is about technology. So often in theater or opera, there's a desire to integrate technology, but it can often feel imposed. It can feel like it's a design element. But in this case, it's actually integral to the story. It is a character. So in that sense, the idea that you know, Simon Powers is now being expressed through a mechanical chandelier and Evie, his wife, has to relate to it, you know, to me, drama exists between people. It's the what we keep talking about, this unnameable thing. It's the energy, the vibration, which is actually a huge theme in the opera. Simon keeps saying, as much as we're talking about stuff, his whole mantra is, it's never the matter that matters. He's talking about vibration.
It's the idea
that matters. So in a way, the opera, to me, what we're saying, it's it's even beyond, you know, can I live longer? To me, the opera is a meditation on the nature of death. And in that sense, it really does look backwards as much as it looks forward. I mean, I remember working with Robert Pinsky, and we were looking at ancient texts like Oedipus at Colonus as inspiration for the structure of this piece. You know, Oedipus's mysterious death in the grove of trees where no one was allowed to come and witness it. And that mystery that I think is part of the most advanced technological processes. It's not all known. There is mystery. There is beauty. There is the inexpressible in art as there is in technology.
But the technology is opening up this different possibility that it will go on. I mean, before, if there was something after life, it was divine. It was a matter of faith and religion, a heaven, the sweet by and by, all that. Here he is, in a way, it's vastly different on the other, because he's helped make this himself. I mean, it's made by his own hand. And yet, it's interesting, in the opera, the flesh and blood humans who remain behind have the same difficulty in buying it, in believing it, in relating to the uploaded mind of Simon Powers.
Yes, but I think what actually really interests me in the libretto is that Simon Powers himself changes once he's in the system. It's one thing when he thinks he wants to become a system, but once he's in the system, it begins to change. And I think that's the idea, that it's not as cut and dry as you know, there's not an answer here. That's what I'm inviting audiences to experience with this opera, that we're not saying this is the future, this is how, you know, one can live forever. It poses questions, this opera, about what is the meaning of life and how we continue to experience ourselves, perhaps after our physical death.
The will is there, and you can hear it in this bit. Simon Powers now uploaded into the system, into the kind of digital realm in the environment of his home, and he's speaking back to the flesh and blood living.
My name is Simon Walter Powers. It proposes I'm alive, like those other famous Walters, the immortal Disney and the immortal Whitman, my fellow inventors. And by the way, I have billions of bucks, and I can still sign checks.
He's uploaded, his body is gone, but he can still sign checks. Okay, Todd McElroy, why does he call Walt Disney, those other immortal Walters, Disney and Whitman, his fellow inventors? What's that about?
I think that one of Robert Pinsky's core ideas in this in the libretto is that he's often said that robot is a name for work, and I think he thinks that, and we all think that one way that you upload yourself and make yourself immortal is by creating works of art, creating work that lasts. And I think Walt Disney and Walt Whitman were out of the box, extremely imaginative, not only creators but creators who had a very broad sense of how much of human existence could be preserved and perpetuated.
Todd McElroy, Diane Paulus, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Chicago, Brian Dickey. He's general director of the Chicago Opera Theater, which will be presenting Death and the Powers in Chicago in April. Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's very, very nice to be with you. This rather short notice. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. Do you think audiences are ready for this? The Robots Opera, Brian Dickey.
Well, I think audiences are very, very ready for anything which is so sharp and innovative as this. We live in a much more inquiring world than once we lived. And I think that it's perfectly true that some opera audiences are a bit conservative and stuffy and dyed in the wool. My company, in fact, has, over the 11, 12 years that I've been here, managed to develop an audience which has a much more positive, inquiring view of opera and opera production. And, of course, one of the reasons for that is because of the extraordinary work that Diane Paulus has done with us over virtually the whole of the period that I've been here. And we've sort of redefined expectations, actually, thanks to Diane and some other colleagues who've done really interesting work.
Chicago, looking forward with the help of Paulus and more. What's the heart of this opera, as you see it, Brian? What's the What's the deep human element in this robot opera?
Well, like all great works of art, it is something that makes you consider your condition, the human condition, and makes one really, really wonder what we are as human beings and how our life's work can be either memorialized or, in the case of past, kept going for, well, forever, yes. Is this really possible? Who knows? It's a fascinating set of questions which are posed by this piece, and I think the audiences who have prepared themselves for it, both musically and through the libretto, will get a huge amount of satisfaction and stimulation out of seeing it.
There's deep human issues, but is there also a historical question here, putting forward a cusp of history where maybe we are facing this frontier of awareness, sentience being transferred, becoming transferred into a computer realm?
All kinds of bizarre things are going on in the world with cloning and goodness knows what weird things can happen. And of course, there are those more religious than I who question very much this. But I think it's terribly, terribly important for us to examine these things. And this opera is one of the means by which these things can be examined and one's conventional wisdoms can be challenged. And we can move out of the box, as it were, completely and look at the world and look at ourselves in a different way. Nothing is static. Thinking is not static. And I'm completely thrilled that Todd McIver, one of the most extraordinary, innovative geniuses working in music today, and this remarkable Diane Paulus have worked together on this. We've been actually involved at COT with this production. God heavens, it must be 6 or 7 years. Mm. Because Diane introduced me to this first 6 or 7 years ago when she was working with us. And I'd encountered Todd in Paris 30 years ago or more. So it's a coming together of great minds, and coming into the Harris Theatre in Chicago, I think we're going to find this is the ideal location for this thing.
Todd, are you pointing us to a new frontier here, or simply an old one in new high-tech clothing? Death and the possibility of life going on. I mean, that's as old as many religions.
I think the interesting thing is how the oldest questions and these new possibilities are mixed and clashing right now. I think something Diane mentioned before is quite interesting, which is that there are no answers. We examine these questions from different characters who have different feelings about it. But in fact, many of the ideas in the opera are live on stage in the music, in the infrastructure, in the way this thing works. So, for instance, Simon Powers and We when we were developing this opera, we talked quite a bit about the fact that our star is James Maddalena, mm-hmm. one of the great baritones in the mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. And here we're making an opera where this unbelievable performer goes into the system and disappears for the
entire... For most of the show.
Exit stage, right.
We're tempted over and over again to say, you know, we got to... Should we put him on the side of the stage? We put him in a box? I mean, we need to see this guy. But constantly we went back to the real idea, which is, no, he really is gone. And since he's gone, he must be represented. He must come alive in a form that nobody expects. And it's not just a trick. He must really come alive in this form, and we must all believe it. So he's somewhere else.
But he's singing live throughout as his voice comes through the whole show.
There's actually a new technique called disembodied performance that we invented for this. He sings live. We measure his movements. We measure his muscle tension. We measure his breathing. We measure things that he's conscious of when he's performing and many things that are just part of his being. And all of that gives us a sense of his emotion, of as close as we can get today to what he really cares about, who he is at that moment. And all of that is translated, analyzed live by our machines. And the stage shows in this visually and sonically.
Brian Dickey, I've just got you for another half minute here. Will this be the highest tech set you've ever worked with in Death and the Powers, Brian?
Yeah, by multiple of several thousand, I would think.
I was waiting to see what Brian would say.
I mean, this is going to be so exciting for the folks here, I must say. It's going to be challenging for the staff in the theatre. The audience is going to be thrilled out of their minds when they see these robots scooting about and the amazing wall work of the designers and the sound designers, everybody. This is something out of this world.
Straight out of the MIT Media Lab, Brian Dickey with the Chicago Opera Theater. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck there, Brian.
Can't wait to see you soon, Brian.
Bye now.
We'll go out with a little bit of the daughter of Simon, Miranda, singing about missing her flesh and blood father in Death and the Powers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Death and the Powers, the Robots Opera, and an imagined time when flesh and blood are history. It's about legacy. It's about life and life that goes on. Here's a scene where two of the characters follow Simon Powers, the lead character in the new opera, into the system, into the digital realm. They go with him. Todd Machover, the composer, is with us. Diane Paulus with us as well, artistic director at the American Repertory Theater, where this will go on March 18th. Opened in Monaco, will be in Boston, Cambridge, and then on to Chicago. You can join the conversation this hour. What would it mean for succeeding generations if the old never exactly died, never fully went away? And will computers more and more capture our legacy, capture us, carry us on? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. The issue is not just about the undead dead here, or the ones transcended into the walls of Simon Power, the billionaire's home. It's about, above all, his daughter staying behind, living with the dead not gone. How did you work through what that might mean, Todd Machover?
I think the character of Miranda, I remember even before we had the story of Simon Powers and this particular story, we thought about a story of a young girl growing up and thinking about her relationship to the past, to her parents, and to her own future. And so I have two daughters myself. Actually, our older daughter is 17 mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm. Happy birthday.
And, yeah, and I think the idea of keeping the tie with everything that's gone before that you care about and still finding yourself and your own independence and that balance is something that meant a lot to me in this opera. And in many ways, Miranda, to me, is the central character. Simon goes into the system, and Miranda's the one who has the hardest time deciding what that means, if this is him, if she wants to follow him, and if she doesn't want to follow him, what it means to totally cut off.
But, Diane, here's the full tension. Because of this great supercomputer or whatever you want to call it, the system, he's not gone. We grieve when we lose those our parents and loved ones. On the other hand, it gets really messy if they're not really gone. And there's something fundamental about having to kind of make it up from scratch with the best we can patch together of what they hoped we would know and remember. That's not her path here. Her father still surrounds her.
Yes, although she has doubts about whether she can still hear him, whether that's really him. She goes mm-hmm. through all those periods of questioning, of frustration, and then ultimately, as you alluded to, kind of anger at her father because she's been left behind to deal with the real world. And actually, three quarters into the opera, there's a quite a theatrical moment where we have a chorus that Robert Pinsky wrote for us, a chorus of the human miseries that makes an appearance in the opera. They sort of invade the stage. And this was an idea I had of, you know, we have a very small ensemble of seven singers and lots of big technology. And I thought, what would happen if all of a sudden 40 people flooded the stage and they represented the miserable, the children, the starving. We have this chorus. It's a volunteer chorus here in Boston, and we'll be amassing a volunteer new chorus when we hit Chicago. And believe it or not, we had a misery chorus in Monaco, too.
You, too, can be part of the misery chorus.
That was a gamble in Monaco.
That
we weren't sure.
A gamble. But, you know, for me, that's Miranda. That's Miranda. She brings these people in front of her father because she says, Daddy, listen, look, what about the starving? You know, it's fine for you to go into a system and detach and, you know, connect on more sublime levels to yourself and your existence. But what about life that's still going on? So that's an argument that is in the opera, that is a tension.
And she has to decide, I mean, whether she wants to stay in the realm of flesh and blood and death and suffering. That's a big decision. Before we even get to that, though, his wife has to decide whether she can still interact in an intimate way with this dematerialized husband. Here's a bit where it's called, this is Evie's Touch, where at night Simon's wife, Evie, played here by Patricia Risley, enters and sings a duet with the chandelier that is now sort of this great kind of diaphanous, beautiful chandelier now inhabited by Simon that descends, almost envelops her. They share memories of when they first dance, and she calls out to her now disembodied husband to, she says, touch me. Touch me, the wife, and the dematerialized husband in Death and the Powers. Let's get a call from Charlottesville, Virginia. Padma Sani. Thank you for calling, Padma Sani. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
This is a very fascinating thing for me to listen to. Just a comment, if I may. This desire to keep oneself going after death has been a kind of a human desire, I guess, for ages. As you know, the Hindu system, which, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago, developed this whole idea of reincarnation and rebirth, and you get reborn, not necessarily as a human all the time, but you may even be reborn as a cow or
yes,
a rat or something.
Yes,
chandelier.
So that was the whole idea of this reminded me of that. That this is a philosophy and a system of religious belief that people believe in. And, you know, how else do you explain a Mozart, for instance?
Padmasani, then, can you imagine, Padmasani, somewhere in the future, computers preempting reincarnation, that people might actively step, you know, upload into a computer before they actually die, and so they break out of that Hindu cycle?
Well, yes, this is all in the realm of mystery for me at the moment. But it's so fascinating that somebody is conceptualizing something like this, a kind of leaving oneself to be functioning in other ways.
Absolutely. I'm so glad for your call. Todd McIver, I was reading here, Malcolm McIver, talking about in this opera and in the whole sort of transhuman singularity movement, the possibility, he writes, that this is filling a void that religion for many people, maybe high-tech secularists, used to fill but no longer does or can. And so it's imagined through the form, this ancient notion in Hinduism and many other religions. Is there some kind of religious impulse buried within this very high-tech, futuristic motif of the system of computers? Do you feel that in your own early conception here or not?
I think there is, but something that comes to mind is that one very big difference when you're talking about technology, and it's embodied strongly in the character of Simon Powers, mm-hmm. is that I thought of this when with that last call. Mm-hmm. Most religion has to do with understanding and accepting the world, accepting the forces and accepting what might happen to you and understanding that. I think
accepting, but also imagining heavens and things that are based on faith.
That's right. But I think one of the crucial differences with technology, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. is that it's man's ultimate attempt to control the world. Mm-hmm. It's an active attempt to define your future. So Simon Powers, this is actually you can't imagine a greater act of hubris than this, that he has made his own system that will perpetuate his own life in the way that he wants, you know, the parts of it he wants and the form that he wants. And I think Diane pointed out before that one of the interesting things in the opera is that even for Simon Powers, the very powerful, very successful, mm-hmm. very capable person, when he makes this system and enters into it, it isn't exactly what he thought either, and he doesn't exactly develop in that system the way he imagined. And I think one of the biggest limits to technology, and we know this all so well, is that we can make all kinds of technology, but the way the technology evolves, its implications, what happens with it, is very seldom the way we imagine it.
Diane, in all the ancient texts, things don't go too well when humans aspire to that level of hubris, that level of, you know, to control. What about here? Is there a moral in Death and the Powers about that kind of attempt in what may be a technologically empowered age on that front?
You know, I know it was so important when we were talking about the conception of this piece that if nothing else, technology not be viewed as evil. And I think that can be an easy reduction in theater pieces or operas that deal with technology, that, you know, it's doomsday, that, you know, we're all going to be robots and we'll all be controlled by technology, and where's room for mm-hmm. the human spirit and art? And so my strong goal with how we've staged this and brought this into a work, a production, is to feel the technology on a level that is, as I said before, mysterious, that we don't always know what we're looking at, that mm-hmm. there are questions. Even the question at the very end of the opera, when Miranda, the daughter, is faced, do I follow my father or do I not?
He's saying, come on, come
He's
to the
coming.
Light, leave the flesh behind.
Exactly. And to me, it's the question of whether she'll enter or not that's important, and the kind of tension she feels, and the questions it puts to all of us about times of our life or timing in our life and, you know, what we hope for our lives. And, you know, the idea that one can't reduce this opera to a moral is really important. I think it's much more about a question that maybe can never be answered.
It's not the Frankenstein sort of depiction here. It's though there's certainly light and dark in the depiction of Simon Powers, and he's leaving behind some troubles on Earth. But you're open to not that black and white a judgment.
Yes, and I think it's the genius of Robert Pinsky and how mm-hmm. he's framed the piece as this, you know, robots opera, mm-hmm. because it's quirky. You know, it's these robots who are enacting this ritual, and there's a lot of mystery. Who are the robots? How did they get there? Mm-hmm. What is this human drama? You know, they say they get human rights status credits if they perform the opera. You know, so there's also a humor to the opera that I think is important, that it's not a didactic message. That is being proselytized here. It's more questions and meditations on, as we've heard from our callers, you know, certain philosophies of life.
Let's hear that moving moment where Simon Powers, in the system, and his daughter Miranda, still very much flesh and blood, have the back and forth about whether she should join him.
Come into the light.
Come into the world of light.
Come into the light.
I won't enter death, my body away from the light. The body of this death is who I am. It is my mind. I am this body of death. It is my mind. It's who I am. I am this body of death. I am this body
father and the daughter, Simon and Miranda, he says, come into the light from the meat, the flesh and blood. She says, no, this body, the body of this death is who I am. I mean, Todd, when you hold it up against this notion of a perpetual kind of machine that is immortal, the interesting thing is it makes human life look most significantly not like life, but like death. It becomes the most salient fact about it. She says, I am the body of death here, though it's the thing we embrace as life itself.
Well, I think death is what defines the limits and the suffering, the real mm-hmm. situation people have mm-hmm. is what defines her. But it's also the total emotional range and the empathy and the connection with other people, which Simon, I think, loses. It's very touching, actually, when Simon goes into the system, is completely disembodied and realizes more and more that he actually misses his daughters and can't find out exactly how to still reach out to her.
The billionaire wants to have it all come over to me. He says, Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm just so struck. Two things. One, the music is just wonderful. I do concert singing, and I wish I were in that chorus. But I think
we can still sign you up.
You will.
Thank you so much.
I'm reading a book right now called Alone Together, and what I'm haunted by is that in that book it's indicated that in some cases people are preferring perfect robots in their programs over human beings. And the question really becomes, where do our souls come into this? Or are we just finally, at the end of the day, just a series of makeshift programs, and ultimately that all that we are could literally be recorded on spools of tape or thrown into programs. And it raises such philosophic questions about the identity of what, in God's name, forgive me, God, but what it means to be human.
Yes.
Whatever level of perceptive, you know, intelligence at a higher level one might believe in, it just raises extraordinary questions, and you almost wonder if from the primeval dawn of our beginnings, is this what we were headed towards?
Exactly, Peter, exactly. Thank you so much for that call, Diane. Diane, is it the soul that's filtered out when Simon steps into that great digital realm, or the soul that's what's captured?
I think the quest is to capture the soul, and I was thinking as I was listening to Peter speak that it is the music. I mean, it is, we can't forget the form that this story is taking, which is an opera, and it's live. So as much as it's technological, there are performers performing live, and they're reacting differently. And despite all this technology, every performance is different, and every energy that happens at a show is in the moment and about the present moment. And that's critical to me, to feeling the ephemeral, actually, nature of the event.
Well, this feels very much of the present moment, even as it looks far to the future. How far, I guess, we don't know. Diane Paulus and Todd Macover, it's been great having you with us. The show opens in Cambridge, Massachusetts, March 18th.
Actually, in Boston, at the Cutler Majestic.
Oh, at Boston, the Cutler Majestic.
Yes.
And Chicago, April 2nd. Death and the Powers. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
It's really
been
a pleasure.
You can see the libretto by Robert Pinsky at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.